morning and welcome to Senate Finance. It is February the 20th, and present at the table are Senator Meyer, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and Senator Fairclough. I believe Senator Olson is here, and he'll be here in a few minutes. Today, we want to get an overview from the Department of Administration regarding the upcoming contracts that they're in the middle of negotiating right now. Senator Olson has joined us at the table for the record.
Morning.
So Curtis and Nikki, if you want to come up to the table, they've made a presentation for us. You all should have packets in your packet. And afterwards, Curtis, I think what we'll let you do is go through your presentation, and if I could ask the members of the committee to hold questions until the end.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration, and with me today is Nikki Neal, who is the Director of Personnel and Labor Relations. She's held that post for 6 years, and sorry to say that she'll be retiring this summer after 30 years of service with the state, and will greatly be missed. We have a couple of lifelines I just want to identify in the audience. Kate Sheehan and Nancy Schutch, both are deputy directors of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations, and also Scott Earhart, who is our director of finance. And also I'd like to recognize former Senator Jim Duncan and the GGU bargaining team, which is about a dozen people. They're in the green blazers in the back, and I want to thank them for their attendance today.
Well, Senator Duncan, well, good to see you back here.
Before we start the presentation, there's something that I just want to put on the record, and that is, as we look back at contracts, and you'll see dates during this presentation, we'll talk about certain times when things have happened, it is not an indictment of past practices. It's not. All previous contracts were bargained at the table, agreed to by the state, agreed to by the parties, approved by the commissioner and the administration at the time, and represent probably bargaining priorities that were in place 10, 15 years ago that maybe today we might look at and not understand what was the priority at the time. But again, these are contracts that we have bargained and in good faith and are what we're working on right now. First thing, negotiations are mandated by Public Employment Regulations Act, which is in statute. Bargaining begins in accordance with the terms set forth in collective bargaining agreements generally commences in the months of October and December. In this particular year, we started in October with one union and January with another. The state must negotiate and enter into written agreements on matters of wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment. These are considered mandatory subjects for bargaining. They include cost of living, merit increases, pay increments, leave accrual, and health insurance. The state may, but is not required, to negotiate permissive subjects of bargaining, for example, classifications, benefits for employees, and representation of non-permanent employees. Monetary terms of the agreement must be submitted to the legislature no later than the 60th day of the legislative session, which would be March 15th, to receive consideration during the calendar year, which is also statute. And we have worked with both unions to let them know that it is the state's intention to meet that deadline. If negotiations do not lead to an agreement and mediation fails, employees, except the productive service personnel, i.e. state troopers, have the right to strike. Employees who are on strike do not get paid, but may not be terminated because they choose to lawfully strike. Striking employees may be replaced either temporarily or during the duration of a strike or permanently under certain circumstances. Our goal is to achieve a fair and balanced agreement. Contracts are negotiated for 3 years. It can be less than 3 years, but by statute, no longer than 3 years. And the typical bargaining by the state on a cycle of 3 to 5 separate agreements each year. With the contracts that we have right now, the contracts that expire as of June 30th, 2013, is the Alaska State Employees Association, also known as GGU, which is approximately 8,200 positions. We also have the Alaska Public Employees Association, known as SU, the Supervisors Unit, which is about 2,200 employees. And then we have the Confidential Employees Association of about 192 employees. So this particular year, we're negotiating with just a little bit shy of two-thirds of the state workforce. Next year will be the year for the Marine Highway System. With a few other ones, we have the Public Safety Employees Association with about 487 employees. We have the AVTAC, which is down in Seward, their teachers, which are 39. Inman Boat Union, which is 654. Then we have the Marine Engineers and also the Master Mates and Pilots. The following year, that expire in June 30, 2015, we have the Alaska Correctional Officers Association, Public Employees Local 71, and the Teachers Education Association of Mount Edgecombe, which is 29. One thing, too, is we have non-coverages or exempt, which are not covered by a bargaining unit, and there's approximately 1,359 exempt positions. That would be characterized as your commissioners, deputy commissioners, directors, the majority of Department of Law being the attorneys at law. The average yearly base salary for FY12 is represented in this slide. Depending on the association, the salary varies greatly. For the three that we're negotiating this year, the GGU members have an average of pay about $55,000, and the SU, or the Alaska Public Employees Association, about $80,000. And then the Confidential Employee Association, which is the HR folks, about $55,000 a year, and it goes across the board. One thing, too, and then the non-covered, exempt, partially exempt, that average yearly pay is $96,000. The total personal services line for the executive branch is close to $1.7 billion with all these wages. The average employee benefit percentage is approximately 49%. That varies a little bit per union, but it is an average. On top of their yearly salary, their employee benefit is 49%. This does include the geographical differential that the unions do receive. So I do want to make that note. The particular units that we're bargaining with right now is the Alaska State Employees Association, which, according to this slide, has 8,900 positions. In the previous slide, you saw 8,200. This is the total budgeted positions. 8,200 was the snapshot in time from a report that we did of how many employees were on the payroll at that time. So that's why the variation of numbers. This particular unit, the average age of their employee workforce is 44, and they have just under 8 years of service. It goes back to the yearly salary of $55,000 a year, and their yearly payroll is $414 million. The Alaska Public Employees Association, the supervisories unit, again, about 2,400. Their average age is a little bit older. Obviously, they have more years of service as they've advanced in their career, and they're close to 14 years of service. And monthly pay again, $79,000, a little shy of $80,000. And the gross pay for all their members, which includes the premium pays but excludes the benefits, is $173,000 cost to the state. The Confidential Employees Association, the HR folks, again, 201 actual positions, $55,000, and a little shy of $10 million. And their average years of services is 8.2, and the majority of these employees do work for NICI in personnel and labor relations. Monetary terms, and that's something that we'll be coming forward with the legislature to discuss with you, and that is they're made up of several components, one being the cost of living increase. General wage increases are granted to all bargaining units, typically effective July 1st of every year of the agreement. One thing that we have is we have merit and pay increments, which I think we'll discuss a little bit further. And merit steps are basically on the pay scale. You start as an A and you work down to an F. So every year you will get approximately 3.5% raise while you're in state service. At which time, once you hit the F step, then you wait every 2 years for your pay increment or your pay increment, which is approximately 3.75% of your pay. This is in statute and was a new addition to the contract in 2008-2009 as far as establishing the merit increases and the pay increments. And this is on top of a cost of living increase. So when we look at the units that we're bargaining with right now, we'll use GGU as an example. If in granting a 1% increase in FY14, that's worth about $6.6 million. But cumulative over 3 years would be over $46 million, the 1%, how it multiplies. And then on top of that, you have their merit increases in pay increments, which are already part of the base contract. And that is valued in the first year at about $15 million, with a cumulative over 3 years of going to $105,000. The site also reflects the same for the supervisory unit and the confidential unit. So when we're at the bargaining table, these are the numbers that we're looking at. It's not just the percentage, but it's also what the cost of this is for the life of the contract. Monetary terms, with this understanding the increases over time. Now, this is a snapshot of a state employee's salary. If they were hired in 2006 with the COLA and with their merit and longevity steps, they would have received in that 7-year period a 38% pay increase if you were a brand new hire. If you had been in the state system and you were at the G step down the scale and receiving your pay increments every other year, your pay increments, you would receive an approximately 28% increase in pay over 3 years. On the column also, we did put the cost or the consumer price index and what that averaged. And so you have about 18.3 is the consumer price index. The COLA that was granted was 17%, and like I said, then you add the merit and the pay increments and you get to the 38 and the 28% respectively. But it's just a snapshot of what those costs are and what they have been over the last 7 years. And also on this slide, the state has been very generous in the example that we're one of the only states in the country that granted raises every year for our state employees during the recession that hit in 2008 or the financial issues that we had in 2008. Florida, for example, has not had pay raises for 6 years, and the federal government this year again voted not to give federal employees raises, which is the fourth year. An issue that has developed, I think, into the 800-pound gorilla in the room is the leave issue. We have leave accrual for employees. And you can see it there. If after, you know, when you start to your first 2 years and you earn 24 days a year, and then 2 to 5 is 27, 5 to 10, 30, and then 10 years is 36 days. It's important to note, though, there is not sick leave. This is personal time off. This includes your sick leave. In 2000, all the bargaining units converted from a sick leave and a vacation time into personal time off, which was a huge transition for the state to make. One thing is there were caps before on how much leave could be accrued during the time, and in 2000, during that negotiation session, that did not make it in the contract where there are caps for state employees. Excuse me. Currently in the contract language, employees must use 1 week per year. And employees may cash in unlimited leave during, as providing they maintain a 37.5% hours. The value of leave, with the exception of non-covereds, the exempts, leave is valued at the employee's current rate of pay. And so what that is if you are an employee that started, you have 10 years of service, and you have leave that you did not use, or you have accumulated since the day you started, and you started at $20, and now you earn $40, all your leave is valued at $40. Where exempts and non-covereds, the leave is valued at what you earned it at. If you earned it at $40, it stays at $40 until you use that, and then you go up to the next. So that is something that has grown quite a bit. And with that, we have a working reserves account in statute that we use to pay the cash in and the accrued leave that are upon separation. And one thing to note is we have employees that now have 3,000 and 4,000 hours of built-up leave. We have in one particular, in some of the unions that we looked at, some of the bargaining units, if three people were to leave, they would be paid over $500,000 in excess leave, just three employees. The leave liability for the state of all bargaining units is $164 million and is growing. Last year, we paid out, the state paid $36 million out in leave. This is that shows the growing leave liability. In 2009, it was valued at $140,000, and as you can see, it's been growing about $10 million a year, $8 to $10 million a year. This is something that is a concern of the state. It's something that we have expressed to our bargaining unions that it is a concern of ours. They recognize it, and we are trying to address this at the bargaining table of how we can get our arms around this. The state, and I want to be careful here, but the state has discussed putting a cap on leave. So there's a threshold on which they could earn it, and then it's capped to help manage the leave, and at the same time trying to raise the amount of hours an employee has to use in a given year. Because one thing with this leave is it's better than the bank. Because you have the leave, it grows, and we understand this for the employees, and when they get a pay increment, when they get their merit increases, they get their cost of living, 38% over 7 years, that leave grows proportionally. So it is a savings account for a lot of employees, and we do understand that. The next slide we have is on health insurance. The red bar shows that the state of Alaska contributions to the active employees' health plans. As you can see, the list of plans on the right, we do not directly insure all state employees. For some bargaining units, they have used a trust fund, a health trust. Our contributions to the health trust are based upon the economy plan premium for Alaska Care. So our contribution is based on the state health plan. As you can see, our contributions in health care is growing significantly. The root of the cause of the health care cost of growth, and we understand that we all need to better manage these costs. And we need to send a message to the provider community that this kind of cost escalation we've seen cannot be sustained. One thing to note is we are only one of four states that cover full premium for employees, which is 100%. We do not, most states require an 80-20, private sector 80-20, and the state currently pays health insurance at 100% of the economy plan. Health insurance contribution per employee for the state is approximately $15,900 is what we pay for health insurance for each employee. One thing that we've done also is we've looked at national trends, and what we've seen is there's been little to no pay increases since 2007. What we do not have in our bargaining language, but other states do, and that is they've furloughed employees, where they can people doesn't have to go to, or they could lower their hours, or certain days of the week or months, the employees are not to report to work, and that would be leave without pay status. That's in essence a furlough. They've also used extensive layoffs around the country. There have been freezing of longevity pay. There's the increase in subcontracting and managed competition. There's also limitations on legacy costs such as pension, sick or vacation BIPAC upon retirement, and other such long-term costs. And also the greater operational flexibility to provide more services at the same time for lesser cost to taxpayers and citizens. With that comes what the bargaining priorities and concerns are that we have, and we have expressed to the unions as we are negotiating, and that is fiscally prudent cost of living increases. We would like to see how we can handle the reducing the cost of the longevity steps and the pay increments, reducing legacy costs of the leave liability, operational productivity improvements, and we want to make sure that we achieve voluntary and balanced agreements. That is our goal. If a strike does occur, we want to continue to provide essential services to citizens. But again, that for us is a last resort. And with this comes the next steps. And as Nikki has been involved for most of her career in next steps, with monetary terms and with union agreements. As we come to a conclusion, I'd like her to take over the next couple of slides to kind of explain what would happen, what happens in monetary terms.
Thanks, Curtis. So we've negotiated with the unions. We have a tentative agreement. The first thing we do is we submit the monetary terms of those agreements to you all, as they are subject to appropriation. If the legislature fails to fund the monetary terms of an agreement, the next steps vary by bargaining unit. And the action taken can be affected by whether or not the tentative agreement was reached and the monetary terms were submitted timely. And when I say timely, I mean by the 60th day of session, which is March 15th this year. For some units, if the legislature fails to fund the agreement, impasse is considered to exist. For others, they go back to negotiating for a 10-day period in an effort to reach a new agreement. I want to be very clear that each situation has to be evaluated and is very fact-specific. Contract language does vary between the units. The fact that the monetary terms of the parties' agreement might be submitted to the legislature after the 60 day of session does not necessarily prevent the legislature from either considering or funding them. And the appropriation is subject to ratification of the collective bargaining agreement, yes.
I'm going to ask you to break just for a second. I'm going to call a brief at ease. This particular slide that everyone has in front of them. Back on the record. You go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. So once agreements are, we obtain tentative agreements, funds, the monetary terms are submitted to you all for consideration. Typically, at that point, the union membership has not yet ratified their collective bargaining agreement. So if the funds are appropriated and the union membership does not ratify the agreement, then the funding is appropriately reduced or proportionately reduced. So the next slide is a flow chart that gives you kind of the roadmap. And ideally, we'd follow that top level in that we'll negotiate with the unions, we'll reach a voluntary agreement, submit the monetary terms to you all, and the monetary terms are funded through an appropriation. If the legislature fails to fund the monetary terms, as I mentioned earlier, for some contracts specify that impasse exists. Others require us to return to negotiations. If impasse exists, we'll often enter mediation. If we're not successful in mediation, for class ones, we go to interest arbitration. And when I say class ones, as Curtis mentioned, we're referring to troopers, correctional officers. There are some pockets of class one employees in other units as well. It is the state's position that we are not required to go to interest arbitration with units that have a mixed membership. And I mean they're not solely class one, until the membership votes to strike. If impasse exists, we have a couple options. We can implement the state's last best offer. However, any monetary terms are subject to appropriation. Or we can continue with the status quo, meaning continue under the terms of their current collective bargaining unit or agreement. And in both those situations, we would continue to negotiate with the unions. Questions?
That concludes our presentation.
Thank you. Members of the committee, do you have some questions? Go ahead, Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just want to verify or clarify. The legislature does not set a cap or a limit. In other words, the legislature does not say to not bargain or agree over 1% or 2% or 3%, et cetera. You bargain, then you come back and ask the legislature for the funds to fund the agreement after the fact. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes, you're
okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Curtis, you did a really good job of covering the questions that were hanging out in my mind. I think you probably answered a lot of questions for the members of the committee as well. Could you expand a little bit on the comparison of our contracts with other states?
Seattle specifically.
Senator Fairclough would like you to talk about Seattle specifically. Senator Fairclough, would you? Seriously, would you ask the question, because you have some information that I don't have, and you can kind of round this out a little better.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under 29-40-210, it talks about cost of living differentials, and so I was looking that up to see how we were comparing ourselves and who we were comparing ourselves with, and it appears under 23-40-2010A that we specifically compare ourselves to Seattle, Washington. Could you expand on that? Why?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, are you looking at the Alaska Labor Relations Agency at PARA 2340? Is that what you stated?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not certain specifically what you're referring to. Is it a cost of living?
2340-2010 agreement, cost of living differentials, A, and then it goes through some of the information on your slides. And specifically, the plan shall provide that salaries paid as of August 26, 1977, to employees residing outside the state shall remain unchanged until the difference between those salaries and the salaries paid employees residing in the state reflect the difference between the cost of living in Alaska and living in Seattle, Washington.
Okay, I apologize, Representative Fairclough, but we're going to have to get back to you on that.
Thank you. You had talked about Florida and the federal government not paying for any step increases. Are there other states that you could bring into that discussion? Or are you aware of some others?
Just one second, Senator, and I believe I have.
You know what? Let's go ahead and call brief at ease. Go ahead and get. Curtis, go ahead.
As far as the information, Mr. Chairman, for the information as far as other states, through the National Association of State Personnel Executives, 22 states were present at the most recent meeting. Of that, 20 have not had pay increments or salaries. Over that, only two have been given raises over the last 2 years. Nikki was there in attendance and can speak more directly to which states and what they have been doing.
What was that organization?
Senator, it was the National Association of State Personnel Executives.
Okay, and there were 20 states there. Okay.
Yeah, there were 22 states in attendance. Only two, Alaska being one of the two states that have continued to give pay increases. Delaware has given increases the last few years. The other states there have not given cost of living increases. Very few have even provided merit steps. There were two states, Louisiana and one other, which I'm not recalling, that were going to give increases this year for the first time in several years.
Thank you. Before I ask you any more questions, and I would like you to come back to the table, Senator Duncan, as a former member, and I don't know if you want to come up here and talk because you're in the middle of negotiations, but you're a former senator, and I would certainly give you permission to come up and address the committee if you'd like. If not, I understand.
I prefer to listen.
All right. Thanks, Senator. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm very familiar with teaching contracts because that was my profession, being a teacher and administrator. And in those contracts, they have what is referred to as steps and columns. And then there would be a cost of living adjustment. Are we talking about the same thing that in the contracts that you're dealing with, are there steps and columns?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy. Our salary schedules are structured typically a little bit different, but we have salary ranges and then steps. So you're assigned a salary range and then you advance throughout that salary range based on typically years of service and performance.
And the term raise is somewhat, there doesn't appear to be a total agreement on what a raise is. And I'm just curious, when you, in your bargaining, the language of a raise, is that the COLA increase that jacks up the columns, the steps? I'm trying to understand.
Yes, through the chair. The cost of living increase that's negotiated increases a salary schedule completely. So if we negotiate a 2% increase, the entire salary schedule goes up by 2%. Merit steps are what we call an employee, that an employee advances to throughout their salary range. Merits are, your typical employee is eligible for one a year for the first 5 years, and then they advance into pay increments, which is a 3.75% increase every 2 years thereafter.
Okay, just one last question for the chair. Is it fair to say that if an individual is in the bargaining unit and they don't get a COLA, is it fair and accurate that they can say that they did not get a raise? I'm trying to understand the terminology of the term raise, because in some instances, there are folks that don't get a raise, but they move on columns or steps. So I just want to make sure that I understand what...
Senator Dunleavy, my opinion is that they are still getting a raise if they're not granted, if the whole unit's not granted a cost of living increase, they're still eligible for their merit increases or pay increments on the appropriate dates. So they are still seeing an increase in pay, and in my mind, that's a raise.
So other than the people who are, for how many years was it where you go to, every other year for the merit increases?
Mr. Chairman, that's approximately 5 years.
Okay, so other than the people that have worked after beyond 5 years who might fall in between, is there anybody in state government that doesn't get a step or a merit increase of some kind with or without the contracts? Represented.
Elected officials
would be that, but represented units that don't get.
Senator, for the most part, that is correct. There are some marine highway that do not have merit and step increases. They get a strict COLA. But those, again, for the number of employees that we have, that amounts to probably less than 1,000 as opposed to the 16,000 workforce that we have. But for the most part, everybody is in their pay, they get a merit and going to move into merit in our pay increments. And that is something that we've worked very hard with, have the unions understand that even though it's in statute, the merit and the pay increments, it is still an increase to the salary, and your COLA is on top of that. And that's where the one slide that we have on 11 to represent that how an employee's salary has gone up 28% to 38% over the last 7 years. But that is a combination of their merit pay increments and the COLAs that were granted or agreed to in bargaining.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so the liability of the state, though, has gone up even more than that 38% because the health care costs and the benefit that we invest in on behalf of the programs are more. Can you give us a cost increase to the state?
Well, through the chair, Senator Fairclough, that is something we would get back to you. We can narrow that cost down for you, but that is correct. As we've seen, healthcare premiums continue, and they're paid at 100%. And along with the fact that the value of their leave, without a cap, has continued to grow, and the liability is such that again, that is an issue that we've putting dollar amounts to when we see that, as we've seen that liability grow. Like I said, it was in 2000 when everybody started out with a new program, it wasn't an issue. Now as we look back 23 years later, we're seeing it being a huge liability that continues to grow, and that's one of the issues that we have talked with unions at the bargaining table is how do we try to wrestle that liability either through a cap, a possibly different leave accrual rating for new employees. Those are things that we want to look to see how we can wrestle that one, because again, that cost is continuing to grow.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the conversation about how we determine cost of living. I may be reading this particular statute incorrectly, but what I'm wondering is, at a point in time when this was passed into law, we chose Seattle, at least it looks like that. But if that's wrong, we chose somewhere. And I'm wondering, the somewhere that we've chosen, where that fits inside of the entire 50 states.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, that the particular statute that you're referring to.
Can you get just a little closer to that mic, sure. Please? You're worse than I am.
The particular statute that you're referring to, we apply that to the Marine Highway System, and they do receive what we call a cold cost of living differential for living in the state of Alaska. But what I can't explain to you is why we only apply that to them. And so I'll have to look into it and get back to you.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. while you're doing some research on that, again, the secondary question would be, when we establish cost of living, how often do we look at it, and who are we comparing ourselves to establish it? I'm thinking Hawaii, where the cost of living exceeds Alaska, and probably I couldn't say a good state, but I'm sure there's a spectrum of the cost of living in different states, and I'd like to see where we land when we're establishing that.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, what I can tell you is that the cost of living increases that we negotiate through collective bargaining, and that typically similar ones are actually approved by you all in statute for non-covered employees. We do not apply that statutory provision. That's, I believe, referring to a geographic differential opposed to a cost of living increase. But again, we'll look into that.
Curtis, you had mentioned the leave accrual liability, and that was $163 million?
$164 million, yes.
Is in leave accrual, do you figure, is there an additional cost of benefits in there, or is that just strictly time and salary?
It is strictly, Senator, strictly time and salary.
Okay.
for that calculation.
All right. You know, I'm a little concerned about the what I call the road warrior or zombie apocalypse scenario where, you know, oil would drop down in price to something, some level that years ago we couldn't have even imagined it being that high, you know, $85 or something. And the impact on the state would be really, devastating, actually. I'm worried about the state employees. And do we have a system set up for furloughs if we have to do that? And furthermore, do the unions have like a fund to take care of their people through that period of time as well? And I know they have the ability to make money from different insurance pools and those kinds of things. Is any of that money going aside to take care of employees should we come to the zombie apocalypse?
Senator, as far as the first part of the question, the state in its contracts does not have furlough language. We do have layoff language. As far as individual unions and bargaining units, you would probably be better to answer from them, and we can have an outreach to find out what type of programs they might have for their employees, but I can't speak for the bargaining units and what they might have or not have available to their membership.
And take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. Questions from the committee? Any further questions from the committee? Senator Hoffman and then Senator Olson.
Chairman, my question is to Ms. Neal. Since we do see an increase in accrued leave over time, do you see or is it monitored where individuals that are getting closer to their retirement date move to areas of the state that have higher cost of living? Or is it that not something that is monitored by you?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there is certainly rumor of that, especially with Tier 1, since I think employees beyond in other tiers have to spend, I believe it's 50% of their career in a location that has a geographic differential. But for Tier 1, any time counts. And so It's not something that we monitor. They apply and compete for those jobs. We hear rumor of it at times.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure who to direct this to, but one of the issues that I'm assuming it's Ms. Nikki, there, as you look at the negotiations, you start going to the impasse, and you go to you talk about interest arbitration. Why don't you have binding arbitration in there to try and make it so that you're have a little more directed path, and as opposed to just going to another interest arbitration in general?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, actually, interest arbitration is binding.
It is.
It is, yes.
And that's statutory, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
On page 17, it talks about at the bottom when the funding is reduced proportionally. What funding is that when you're there trying to get these negotiations under control and you do hit a bump in the road?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, what this is referring to is that the tentative agreement, when we bring the monetary terms to you all, the agreement has not yet been ratified. So once if the membership does not ratify it, typically the legislature has already funded the monetary terms, so that funding is reduced by what was not ratified.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have we done an analysis of the effectiveness of a 37.5-hour work week versus a 40? Again, rumor has it, at least, that the 37.5 was implemented based on sometimes we pay overtime, and that overtime kept nipping us. And so by doing a 37.5 work week for our employees, we were getting rid of that potential liability out in the future. I don't know if that's true or false, but can you tell me why we're at a 37.5 work week and not a 40, and is there any analysis in there? When we look at labor negotiations and contracts, are we talking about that, or is everyone happy with 37.5?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I'm not aware of any analysis that's been done. I honestly don't know how we got to 37.5 in the first place. However, it is something that's been negotiated. So in order to increase the hours per week, we would need to negotiate that with each union. And you ask about overtime. That's an interesting point. Perhaps that was the situation in the beginning, in that the FLSA does not require overtime until after 40 hours. And when I say FLSA, I mean the Fair Labor Standards Act. However, under most of our collective bargaining agreements, we pay overtime after 37.5 hours.
That actually goes back to statehood, doesn't it? I mean, that 37.5 hour work week.
Well, I can tell you it's been 37.5 hours for my 30 years with the state. There were a couple attempts to move to 40 for short periods of time.
Your opinion, or you know, that was negotiated? That wasn't some statute that was set up years ago?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how it originally came into play. However, it is currently in our collective bargaining agreements.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was statute. I mean, that's a long time to have. And I think it does go back to statehood. I see Chris in the back. You apparently have some knowledge on this. When I was with the university, there was about $300,000 or $400,000 per year in overtime differences between the university that required a 40-hour work week and the state. Not a difference between the two. It was a difference if the university had gone to a 37.5-hour work week, they would have paid $300,000 or $400,000 more in overtime. I'm not sure if that's still the number, but... any ideas, and probably, Curtis, you're not the person to ask on this, but bear with me. If not, just say you can't answer it, and that's fine. We'll move on. So currently we have $25 million shot through agencies in automatic increases regardless of the contracts. And then the contracts, well, we don't know what they are, but they're probably going to be in an additional 10 to 15 $20 million this round. Has anyone done an analysis on which services given a flat budget, given that revenues decline, we're hanging by the thread of oil prices right now, has anyone done an analysis on how many layoffs might have to be resultant from the pay increases or services that are going to have to be cut? Something's got to give. We can't continue to just pour money into state government. I'm not even talking about wages. I'm talking about all the other stuff we're doing. And we see the declining revenues. And those of us who are working on the operating budget here, we have an eye on savings. And thank goodness that people like Senator Hoffman, who had this chair for a few years before me, were diligent and put money in savings, because we need it right now. We're going to need it for a lot of years. But we're going to try not to go into those savings, or to at least go into them in a managed way. So something has to give. Has anyone done an analysis over the amount of layoffs that may have to occur with an additional $50 million, bada bing, that comes from these contracts with the negotiated stuff and with the things that are already in statute, actually? So.
Mr. Chairman, the Department of Administration has not done an analysis of that. One thing that we look to, and that is there's three things with our state government. There's the people, there's the programs, and there's the space. And one of the things the Department of Administration has been doing is looking at our space that we currently have in state-owned facilities as well as private leases, and modifying and looking to reduce the footprint that state government has in its buildings and in private leases to save money. Our initial preliminary estimates, which we think are very conservative, shows an approximate savings of over $125 million in the next 20 years. Granted, that's not when you're looking at this for those type of cuts per year, but it's something we're trying to look at, how we can do stuff more efficiently and save money. A case in point, we've been looking at the Atwood building in Anchorage. We've identified where one agency could, with new space standards, shrink and eliminate three floors, and their potential savings is over $1 million to their budget. And then with that, we can bring agencies in that are in private leases at $2 and $3 a square foot into a building that costs us $1.56 a square foot. So then there's another savings. And so just in the Atwood alone, there's potential $2 million savings. There's some capital cost for reconfiguring the floor and the footprint to do this, but the cost, the payback is within 5 to 7 years. And so we've been looking at those type of studies within the Department of Administration of how we can save money. But again, it's for the long term, not necessarily the short term. But that's just an example of one of the things that we're trying to do.
And certainly, I'm sure the committee and people of the state of Alaska appreciate that kind of foresightedness. That doesn't even cover the $163 million leave accrual. And, you know, and forgive me, do we have a plan for that? I can't remember whether you said that in your presentation. Do we have a plan to bring down that leave accrual and then put everybody on a...
We are in negotiations with the unions. We've had frank discussions about looking at a cap. We've also had frank discussions about a new leave accrual. Again, those are still at the negotiating table. We do not have agreements on those, but it is a topic of conversation that we've had with while we are bargaining. And I think there's clearly an acknowledgement on both parties that the liability, the unfunded liability, is huge.
Senator Fairclough, did you want to ask about the roadmap? Senator Bishop, go ahead. My apologies. I had recognized Senator Bishop earlier.
Excuse me. Curtis, on the page 14, I just got to beat this drum one more time. We've got to do something. We can't continue to go up $100 million every 6 years and expect to stay in business. I have brought some information to your department. I'm sure you're aware of it, and I'd like an update on an idea how to save the state money just in the medical field. I know there's been some discussions going on, and I'd just like an update on that.
What would that be? I'm sorry, Senator, or through the chair, Senator Bishop.
In the area of health care costs, you can get with me offline, and I'll bring you back up to speed on that.
Thank you, Senator Bishop.
Thank you.
Senator Fairclough?
Thank you. One of your slides, you talked, well, you showed us a slide that gave different alternate routes. Let me find the slide. Slide 18. It would be helpful for all of us looking into Alaska's future for us to start negotiating in a standard roadmap so that it would be easier to navigate if the state were put in a position where we couldn't approve a contract based on funds or lack thereof funds or current revenue streams or lack of savings. Is that something that you're negotiating now? I don't know, and if you can't say that, that's fine, but I would just put on the table that it seems like we should at least streamline the process so that we know in future years that we have a roadmap that's the same inside of each of those contracts. And, Mr. Chairman, that liability of $164 million of outstanding leave and being able to take all of that leave at your last exit out salary is increasing that liability exponentially as people stay in the system. I was doing some napkin math on just the 37.5 work week compared to a 40, including vacation. So let's just say that's 130 hours differences, and in 16 years, that's an additional full year off. So for an employee that's 30 years, we've paid almost two full years off outside of the benefit package at a 37.5 work week. So you have to be here 32 years, just a little bit over that, to get an additional 2 years of time off. And that's a great benefit, and it helps employees to be able to get to the bank and do things for their families and volunteer at nonprofits and do wonderful things. But I just would point that out, that it's an added benefit to work for the state. And a final comment, Mr. Chairman, I know that our state agencies are working very hard to compete at attracting new employees from across the nation or from other countries, and sometimes our own federal government is the one that is causing part of the problems. The federal government, COLA, they're snatching our geologists away and our fisheries away, and it's just hard to compete. And so I don't know if we want to issue a letter to the President of the United States, but we talk about a race to the bottom in trying to compete for some things or a race to the top. And if the federal government would stop offering as much COLA as they're doing, we could at least stabilize our salary schedules and our cost differentials. But as the federal government continues to offer that higher amount, it's difficult for states like Alaska to be true to our people and the people that we employ, because we're just competing for that expertise back and forth, and it just continues to raise the bar, and it appears that no one can raise the bar unless we borrow the money from China. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple questions. Are there some bargaining units that cannot strike, like public safety employees or corrections?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Meyer, yes. Class 1 employees cannot strike. That would be like troopers, airport police and fire, correctional officers. And as I mentioned, we have some Class 1 employees in other units, like within the general government and supervisory unit. We have some probation officers, some of the Pioneer Home employees. Those types of employees cannot strike. They're protective service workers.
Okay, and if I could follow up?
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, I have a couple questions here. And then I think you mentioned in one of the slides, too, that the leave, that they can cash in all their leave. It's an unlimited amount. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, yes. An employee, most bargaining units, most of their collective bargaining agreements allow for them to cash in an unlimited amount of leave that they've accrued. They just cannot reduce their balance. They have to leave a minimum of 37.5 hours in their account. But anything above that, they can cash out.
So let me see if I understand leave, Mr. Chairman. Is leave include vacation and sick, or it's all combined?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, we have, for most of our units, It's personal leave. And so we don't have a sick leave bank. So any amount of their personal, they can cash out.
But I guess, Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up, isn't there some concern from a safety standpoint if these guys never take any time off? I mean, that's why we have the leave, is so they can get a little R&R and get refreshed. And, you know, if you got guys out there carrying guns, I'm a little worried that they might be a little grumpy if they don't take some leave. And also, there may be some worker comp issues here, too, that, you know, we may want to consider. Because, frankly, I think leave is just healthy for the state and for the employee.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Meyer. That is why we have mandatory leave usage provisions in our collective bargaining agreements. Most of them do require the use of a minimum of 37.5 hours per year. But when an employee is accruing at the maximum level of 36 days per year, and they're required to use five, they still accumulate quite a bit. And of course, we do have some situations where a department will certify that they didn't have the opportunity to use the leave because of business needs.
Okay, and if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
I know with the police officers in Anchorage in particular, I believe overtime is based on seniority. That's a negotiated item. How is seniority based with the state employees? Or how is the overtime administered? Is it on a seniority basis as well, or how is it done?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, not always on a seniority basis. It needs to be equitably assigned, but there's not a strict seniority system for the assignment of overtime.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You talked earlier about Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3. What's the distribution of numbers of Tier 1s that are still out there that have got the retirement after 3 years as opposed to Tier 3, which is 5 years, and of course, Tier 4, you've got a different set of numbers. What generally is the spread or distribution of those numbers that are out there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we'll have to get back to you with those numbers. Obviously, you know, Tier 1s are starting to decline, but I don't have the numbers available to me now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Curtis, as in your in your presentation, merit and step got mixed up for me. There really isn't a merit increase anymore, correct?
No, there is. The first 5 years, we consider that a merit every year, and then every other year, we call it a pay increment.
Okay. However, in that first 5 years, everybody gets steps or merit.
Correct.
So I guess the word merit became step, I guess, or excuse me, the word step became merit. Okay. Years ago, I asked a question when I was over in the House about merit increases. And my question is, did we merge merit and step because merit really wasn't being used like it should be?
Mr. Chairman, they are merit steps. And unless a supervisor proactively denies the merit increase through a written performance evaluation prior to the due date, the employee is automatically awarded the merit increase.
How often has that happened in the last year? Do you have a number on that?
I don't have a number, but it's not very often.
Yeah. Seems to me that, you know, we complain about employees, et cetera, but often what I see is just poor management regarding these pay issues. What I was referring to, merit increase conversation that I had 15 years ago with a commissioner, it was Commissioner Boyer, I think, at the time. And we asked him, at that time they had an actual merit system. I asked him how many merit increases were denied the previous year, and there had been three out of all the state employees. So it makes me think that, yes, that's why it happened, is that we merged them because they're really, the word merit was no longer applicable in that case. So anyway, you know, for what it's worth, manage better. Tell your people that, you know, if a bad rap is coming on step and merit, it really falls to the manager and the supervisor to take care of that.
Senator, on that note, I do want to point out that something we have learned as far as the state is through negotiations, you do have requests for information from both sides of the table. And we have been asked to provide information to our bargaining units based on our management practices, running reports. And from that, we have learned a lot. They will pose a question to us, we will run the report, and once we look at it, it does raise issues where we as managers need to do a better job, whether it be standby time or other type of leave, or the leave accrual. Again, when we started bargaining, it wasn't something we had thought of, and as we grew in through information requests, we actually saw the magnitude and the problem that it was. And so really through these bargainings, the state has learned a lot by the request of the unions, and we thank them for that.
I'm gonna take just one brief at ease and then we'll wrap it up. Back on the record. Final questions from the committee? Senator Duncan, I'm going to give you one more shot if you'd like it, out of respect for your many years of service.
Mr. Chair, I enjoyed the presentation.
All right. And I hope you'll know, you're welcome to stop by and talk to me anytime or any of the members of the committee. I'm sure they would entertain what you have to say. Curtis and Nikki, I appreciate your time. It was an outstanding presentation. Every question I think that I had is in this slideshow. Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Members of the committee, any other business to come before us? Hearing none, thank you all. We're adjourned.